Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights and Financial Services e-commerce practice groups, was recorded on August 9th during a live telephone conference call. On today's call, we're going to be discussing recent developments in a case filed earlier this week in federal district court against the City of Richmond, California. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that today's call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future, and as always, any expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, not typical for these calls, this call is open to the press, so I want to make people aware of that. Today we have with us returning guest Professor Richard Epstein. He is the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at the New York University School of Law and a frequent contributor to Federalist Society's efforts. He's also a recognized expert and scholar in the field of property rights, and I'm very pleased to welcome him here today. I think he's going to begin with opening remarks, and then ultimately we'll turn to the audience for questions. So, Professor Epstein, please go right ahead.
Oh, thank you so much. This is certainly a story which has gotten more than its fair share of attention the last day or so. I think I've been asked, even in the last day, to probably do three or four pieces on this because people are either agog, aghast, or just downright confused about what is going on. And so what I'm going to do with this particular situation is to start with a brief description of the parties and then something of the transactions that are involved. Well, the plaintiffs in this particular case are a bunch of people who have residential mortgage-backed securities, which in the jargon I'm told is RMBS. I may use that expression from time to time. And on the other side, it's not only that you've got the City of Richmond, but you have an operation known as the Mortgage Resolution Partners. And the two of them are getting together in which the Mortgage Resolution Partners operation, or MSP, is in fact acting as the agent on behalf of the City of Richmond. It contributes its skill in trying to organize these transactions, and the City of Richmond contributes its eminent domain power, and the two of them together are trying to figure out a way in which they can generate profits out of a series of mortgages. The mortgages in question are mortgages which are located in the City of Richmond only in the sense that the security, that is the property which is underlying the mortgage, is in fact located in that town. It's actually a very interesting question to try to figure out where these mortgages themselves are located, and the plaintiffs in their case have said, look, they're extraterritorial obligations, these things have been bundled and repackaged, they're all over the landscape. And so what's happening is the City of Richmond, to the extent that it's not trying to target its eminent domain powers against the real estate, but against these free-floating mortgages that are secured by the real estate, in fact is engaged in an extraterritorial operation. And the sense of that argument, I think, is not completely improbable, because it turns out that if the real estate is there, you've got one party, maybe, but on the other hand, all the other parties are diffused around the world. And the question then is, what are they trying to do? Well, they're trying to use the condemnation power to take these mortgages. It should be emphasized at the outset that most of these mortgages are, in fact, performing mortgages, which means that they're not in default. There is, of course, the possibility that even though the mortgages are performing, that the value of the property, at least in market value terms, may be less than the amount of the mortgage in question. But that's not a completely uncommon situation. People may decide, look, the subjective value of this home is very great to us, even though its market value is less. We're not interested in selling. And so long as the value of the home subjectively understood exceeds the mortgage, they will have a strong incentive to essentially hold it. There are other people who are going to say, look, we're dealing with these transactions in a rising market, and it may well be that the property is underwater today, but it's going to bounce up tomorrow. And in fact, if you look at the particular situation with both the Fannie and Freddie Mac, one of the things that has clearly happened there is both of these companies are surging, and indeed in one of the fine arguments of this particular case, both these organizations are essentially on the side of the plaintiffs because they know, in effect, that the mortgage securities that they hold will, in fact, be heavily compromised if the City of Richmond can go through with this plan. Because if Richmond goes down this road, so can every other city. And indeed, one of the things that the plaintiffs did, in what I regard as an extraordinarily well-drafted complaint, is to indicate that proposals of this sort are brewing about everywhere else. Now, in order to explain what the actual transaction is, what I'm going to do is something I don't normally do, is just to read a paragraph or two from the complaint, in order to explain the way in which the transaction works. And the two paragraphs, for those of you who have it, that I'm going to concentrate on are bits of paragraph 47 and paragraph 48. And it says, on information and belief, once defendants secure the loan at a steeply discounted price that is below the face value, they then tend to replace it with a new loan to be sold into an FHA, they're going to use the federal government, securitized pool in an amount equal to approximately 95% of the underlying home value. Richmond MRP and their investors and partners would thus instantly profit by sharing the spread between the 80% seizure price and the 95% refinancing price. Very accurate. And then in an example provided by MRP, an underwater loan on a house worth $200,000 would be seized by eminent domain for $160,000, which is 80% of its value, and then refinanced into a new FHA loan for $190,000, or 95% of the home value. The $30,000 spread, that's between the 160 and the 190, would be the seizure price, and the refinancing price would be divided after expenses amongst Richmond, MRP, and MRP investors. And if you start looking at this, the question you want to ask is, how does this thing stare up against various kinds of legal documents that could be used to challenge the underlying arrangements? And the complaint, I think, is a very fine job in sort of setting out what some of the various difficulties are in this case. The first of them is, in fact, the question is this an extraterritorial exercise of power? It is well understood under the Due Process Clause that a state only has the power to exercise its rights of taxation over property that is located within the state. If you think about the way the world would work if, in fact, this proposition were false, you would have a situation in which people in Chicago could tax people in Seattle could tax people in Tucson, and so on around the globe, even though the activities in those particular places have little or nothing to do with what's going on. So their argument is these mortgages are, in fact, traded over exchanges, none of which are located in Richmond. There are buyers and sellers involved in these particular disputes, none of which have taken place inside the place of Richmond. And so what you're trying to do in this case is to lever yourself by taking these transactions that are essentially done in all sorts of places in cyberspace rather than on ground, and using your power to reel in these particular mortgages solely on the grounds that it turns out that the underlying property in question is there. Now, think about this as a kind of a puzzling question. What happens in this case if it turns out that these mortgages are in fact mortgages, which most of them are not, and which is personal liability? At that particular point, there's no particular property anywhere, and the general rule is that a creditor can bring, attach, or sue a debtor anywhere he can find him on a matter of personal jurisdiction. So to that extent, we often think about these debts as being ambulatory, and the issue is whether or not the location of the security in a single state ought to be able to change the situation. I'm not aware of any particular law in this particular case which tells how things are going, but it is instructive to note that there is a body of law dealing with usury, which in the olden days when Arkansas was an 8% state, dealt with what we used to call the localization of a loan transaction. And the rule that took place in those cases was as follows. You could enter into a variety of documents under conflicts of law provisions and indicate that the place of the signing of the loan would be the law that would govern it. So instead of having to be subjected to the law in Arkansas, you could move the transaction to New York, even though you had Arkansas security. And this sort of suggests that there's nothing about the physical location of the property which necessarily determines the jurisdiction which is going to deal with the mortgage in question. The issue even gets more complicated because, as I mentioned to you, these are residential mortgage-backed securities, which meant that they've been pushed and packaged and sent all the way into the international or to the national market. So I don't know whether this claim is going to work on the part of the banks. I don't think anybody does, but it's certainly a credible situation. The second argument that the banks make, which is in line with the first argument, again, does not go to either the takings, due process, or contracts clause issues, but what it does, in effect, is it starts going to the interstate commerce clause interest, most specifically those that are dealing with the dormant commerce power. And the argument that is made in this particular complaint says, look, These things trade all over the United States. They're parts of pools that have mortgages from other kinds of states. It cannot be the case that a state can interfere with the operation of the interstate market by disrupting the particular pools of which these Richmond mortgages turn out to be a part, because what happens is this means it's a local barrier to the problem of exchange in other states. In dealing with this issue, it is often said that there's some kind of a balancing test that's put at stake in this situation, so that the city of Richmond would have to be able to come forward with kind of local interest, which dominates the direct harm that this thing will have on interstate transactions and, in fact, on the federal mortgages, you know, Fannie and Freddie type paper that's in there as well. They will argue that what they're trying to do is to stabilize their own community. The question is whether or not that claim is to be taken at face value. In a balancing test, I think the answer to that question is generally no. You have to show how this is actually going to be a means appropriate to that end, and I think it could be said with some degree of power that if these mortgages are in fact stable and are performing, as most of these turn out to be, it seems to be a very odd thing to say that what you're going to do is to improve the status of a community by making it clear in advance that you will confiscate any mortgage that you like to do sometimes in the future, so that it'll be harder for local citizens in need of credit to be able to borrow it. And I guess in my view is I think that that interest really does come out very much second to the one about the free flow of goods and services, and in this particular case, commercial paper across state lines. And so to the extent that you are using one of these federal state kinds of balancing tests, it seems to me that you have a very credible case in looking forward under this transaction to say, yes, this is not the kind of thing that one city can do because of the way in which it disrupts these transactions. This argument, I think, is stronger now because all of these things are securitized so that they are part and parcel of pools with mortgages originating in other states, and therefore it's not just a simple case where the local bank continues to hold the local mortgage in what you might want to call a fully localized transaction. So that's the second kind of issue that one's going to have to face. The third kinds of issues basically are either the contracts clause or the due process clause or the takings clause. And essentially what happens is all of these are basically the same argument. And the way the argument starts to go is this. A mortgage is a property in the sense that it's a lien on particular kinds of real estate. And it is also a contract to the extent that it establishes the relationships between buyers and sellers, or in this case, lenders and borrowers. And that what's happening in this situation is that that relationship is being disrupted by the application of state force against one of the parties, in this case, the lender, who holds the security interest on the real property in question. And so the argument is, what happens if what you do is say the mortgage is to be seized? Well, the private property that is referred to in the Constitution does not only cover land, it does not only cover intellectual property, it covers all interests in land, and those would include, of course, mortgages, which are liens on the property in question. And essentially what's happening in this transaction is that particular lien is being wiped out. And so then the first question is, why is it that you need to wipe this thing out to begin with? And if you start looking at the usual kinds of cases in which it turns out that the eminent domain power is to be asserted, there are three kinds of issues, roughly speaking. There is the public use issue, there is the just compensation issue, and there is the police power issue. And it's probably worth spending a couple of minutes on each of these. With respect to public use, the conventional wisdom is that this is a very broad concept because one can go back to the Kelo decision and before that to a case called Midcraft against the Hawaiian Housing Authority. And in that particular case, Justice O'Connor, at least in the first of these decisions, uttered the fatal word that every time you see an exercise of federal power, state power, over a particular private landowner, it will count as being a taking for public use so long as there is some conceivable underlying stress, score, italicized, bold, whatever you wish to do with that, conceivable purpose for the operation in question. And then this particular position got put a lot broader in many cases in the Kelo situation, where the land of Suzette Kelo and her neighbors in New London, Connecticut, was seized by the local authorities who had an aborted plan to put together some grand real estate development in order to revitalize the city of New London, none of which ever happened. And so you have this very broad language, and then you sort of have these things which everybody would kind of regard as a taking for private use, I think, in ordinary language, seizing houses from one person and giving them to another, which was the situation in Midkiff. In that case, there was a little wrinkle. It was the party in possession was allowed at the instance of the state to take the landlord's interest upon paying fair value for it, or what was alleged to be fair value. In Kelo, it was a slightly different situation. It was not the tenant seizing the landlord interest. It was the state's seizing an outright owner's interest. And Midkiff was an academic situation because most people, in effect, don't identify particularly strongly with landlords. And so when that particular piece of expropriation went on, the general reaction was, this is the kind of case for lawyers. Kelo, of course, gave a huge eruption under these circumstances, because what you had going on in that particular case was an outright transfer of land which forced people off their homes, whereas traditionally the eminent domain power has never been exercised unless there's some very, very good kind of public reason with respect to private residential homes. Transferring it to another private party for commercial development, generally speaking, did not fall into that category. You had to bulldoze something in order to build a road or a hospital or something of the sort. Now, this case is different in some sense from both of them, because what happens here is we're not talking about any kind of possessory interests at all. We're only talking about securitized interests, where the only thing that's at stake are dollars and cents. And so when you start to look at this from the public use question, it's not at all clear that the earlier cases are going to be relevant precedents for the state powers. Let's look at them in a slightly different fashion. If you go back to the kinds of rationales for public use that were given in the Midkiff case, it had a lot to do with the question of how it is that we are allowed to overcome the risk of oligopoly, which is said to attach to the highly concentrated land holdings that existed in Hawaii at the time. I thought, in fact, that the oligopoly argument was rather silly, because if you actually ran it through seriously and tried to figure out what the concentration numbers are, they were far below that which would qualify as an oligopolistic arrangement if you're talking about merger law under the antitrust laws and so forth. But at least take it for its own value. You can see why they are doing it. They believe, in effect, that if they change the way in which this property is owned, they will change the political distribution of power in the state of Hawaii. And that was thought, if not to be a public use, which the Constitution requires, to be a public purpose, which is close enough for government work and would be satisfactory anyhow. In this particular case, or rather, in the next case with Kelo, the argument was we had an land assembly problem. The attack on the other side, which I certainly supported, was why are you assembling this land now long in advance of any time in which you actually know what you're going to do with it? Just wait until there's actually some purpose to be used. But the Supreme Court, in effect, said, look, the deference that we give means that they could do a land assembly early or a land assembly late, and we have to worry about all these problems with respect to holdouts. So essentially what's going on dealing with oligopolies, changing the use of land so that you could put up a residential development instead of a commercial development or vice versa, were all thought to be sufficient to get you into public use. In this case, it's just money. There's absolutely nothing else that's going to happen. There's no holdout problem that you're seriously dealing with, because all of these mortgages and all these mortgage money pools are the ultimate in liquidity. So it's not as though you've got some kind of a blockade issue. There's no change in land use that's going to follow from this stuff. So even under the Kelo Midkiff kinds of situations, I think you could make a fairly powerful argument that simply a refinancing arrangement which benefits the local government cannot be regarded as a taking for a public use, because there are thousands of other ways that governments can go into ordinary markets to borrow the money they need without having to take the loans from these people by way of a forced transaction. So this is not going to be a case in which the city is going to win in a walk on the public use question. And I think, in fact, it may well be a case when it gets to the Supreme Court, as I believe it surely will, that it will come out the other way. So then the second of these questions is, what about the way in which we start to think about just compensation? And it's at this point your jaw drops. Why is it that, in effect, we do not have a very accurate value of what this property is worth by the refinancing arrangement? If, in fact, to give the example, what happens is these characters seize this thing for $190 and then turn around and get a new FHA loan for $190,000, why is not the $190,000 the perfect evidence of the value of the property at this particular point in time? And if that's the case under these circumstances, then these loans are certainly being taken for less than they are worth, because in fact, in this particular pool, they could be sold to voluntary buyers and ordinary transactions for amount far in excess of what's going on. And indeed, that has to be the case, because a voluntary transaction is very cheap to arrange. A condemnation is a highly expensive, deeply controverted type of proceedings now with this particular lawsuit going on. And there's got to be some way in which you can show an allocative gain that is essentially able to justify the high transactions cost, because I can assure you there's nothing in this particular plan which says that the city of Richmond is willing to bear the litigation and valuation and appraisal costs that all of these banks have to do in contesting these kinds of transactions, and surely those things will start to take place. So in my view, if you just take the numbers that were used by MRP, that is the Mortgage Resolution Partners, what they're doing in effect is they're necessarily condemning something for $30,000 less than it turns out to be worth on the market. And since these are liquidated interests and really marketable, doesn't seem to be much of a problem with respect to the valuation on these questions. And it's not like the usual land use case that we have where the argument is, well, it really is worth spending a lot of money taking this particular land, because once we assemble a large plot, we can put on a plant of one kind or another that we could never do if it was fragmented into small kinds of spaces. So in the end, it seems to me that whatever one thinks about all of the exotic issues with respect to extraterritoriality and the like, this thing is going to be very powerful. So the last question is, what about the police power? Well, the police power is, in fact, an important power. And if you go back to the 19th century, even in the old Lochner age, everybody understood that you could condemn property to the extent that it was a nuisance, that it was falling down, that it was a public menace of some kind or another, and do so without compensation. But in this particular case, you're not talking about a ramshackle home. You're talking about a viable mortgage. And the thought that somehow or other you can condemn a mortgage as part of an anti-blight rationale seems to me to be so attenuated as to not even to pass the laugh test. What I think is kind of striking about this case is the following philosophical observation. If you start looking at the previous Supreme Court cases, they are all notable for the level of slack that they have in the way in which modern doctrines tend to be applied. And so there are a lot of balancing tests under the Penn Central case and so forth. There's a lot of talk about rational basis. There are a lot of talks about broad sets of political, legitimate public regulations and so forth. And what happens in this case is the Mortgage Resolution Trust, seeing an entrepreneurial activity, assumes that it can take this pile of deference that it finds everywhere in the law and say, in effect, that it is now able to sneak into this situation. I think they're probably wrong, and let me give the last observation in the following sense. There's a famous case called Armstrong against the United States, in which Justice Black was heard to say in his last sentence that essentially the purpose of the takings clause is to make sure that the public at large should bear those costs which in fairness and justice should not be forced upon a single party. And in that particular case, actually involved a mortgage. There was a company which was a subcontractor, which placed a material men's lien on a ship owned by the United States Navy when the head contractor didn't pay it. That lien is a property interest. And what the United States did is it simply sailed its ship out into open waters, and the lien was dissolved. And so what they did is they took the lien, and by a narrow 5-4 vote, it was a case in which Justice Black said, this is a categorical obligation when you start to wipe these things out. We don't need to talk about all this deference stuff. And so there were really two lines of cases. There is the original Armstrong case, which has that categorical rule, and then you have Justice Brennan in a land use case having to do with the Penn Central, who says, we can't figure out any general rules. This is all an ad hoc balancing test. The mortgage cases in general have stayed with the Armstrong rule. The land use cases have generally stayed with the Penn Central rule. The question that we have to worry about is whether or not these two lines will convert, because we have lots of financial stuff going on now. It's one of the ironies in this case is that Fannie Mae in this particular situation is saying these financial interests really are important. You can't wipe them out. At the same time, there are four suits. I'm involved, not with the suits, but certainly on the issue, suing Fannie Mae for the way in which it behaved in the exercise as a conservator with respect to the shareholders of the Fannie and Freddie Mac, where, again, the claim is confiscation. So what we do is we see a government agency on both sides of confiscation claims. And with that, I think I've spoken more than enough. And so perhaps, Dean, you ought to open it up to questions.
Very good. Thank you, Professor. We will open it up to questions now. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for Professor Richard Epstein, you'll push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Professor Richard Epstein, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to the audience, I want to remind folks who might have been late to the call that this call, unlike many of our telephone conference calls, is open to the press. And while the audience is weighing in, Professor Epstein, let me ask you a quick question. You initially made a distinction between seizing a property and seizing a mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
When you got to the valuation portion of your discussion, mm-hmm. you focused on the value of the home itself, mm-hmm. the value of the property. Shouldn't we be focusing on the value of the mortgage? That is, a mortgage for a $500,000 property, a $500,000 mortgage on a property that's worth $200,000. Aren't we looking at the value of the $500,000 mortgage that might be performing, which is far in excess of the $250,000?
Yes, I did say that earlier on. What happens
okay.
is there's a complexity here. Real estate has two kinds of values. It has market value in exchange, and it has subjective value in use. And the reason why you don't see for sale signs on every house, because there's a mortgage value, is that most of the time the real estate is located with people who in fact value it by their own estimations more than anybody's likely to pay for them. And so the way in which you know that is just imagine what happens if somebody comes knocking on your door and saying, I've seen that the assessed value in this community is $300,000 for your home. Here's $300,000. Give me your house. And people will look at them like they're stark raving mad. In fact, we all know that the actual market value of these homes is lower than what people attach to it. So all you need to do to have a stable market is to assume subjective value is, say, $400,000, market value is $300,000, loan value is $325,000, and the person will keep this thing up. If he were forced to sell, he could only get $300,000 because there'll be nobody out there who will pay him more. But if he's not forced to sell, the situation turns out to be terribly stable, which is one of the reasons why we don't want to have situations where we force people to sell their property against their will, because what it does is it erases the subjective value. And indeed, this is a deeply difficult point in standard eminent domain law, because the government comes through. And what it does, in effect, is says we're taking this house for a public road, and we only have to pay you for fair market value. And since the mortgage is, quote-unquote, underwater, you have to essentially get nothing for this thing, even though you had a $75,000 subjective value, which is one of the reasons why everybody is so resentful with respect to the standard practices dealing with eminent domain. What they do is they see in this as a way to wipe out subjective value, and the Supreme Court has said more times than I care to think that generally speaking, all of these subjective calculations are sufficiently elusive that we rate them for zero when we're dealing with the eminent domain, because we just can't allow people to fake them. You stop the fraud on the one hand, but you allow excessive compensation, confiscation on the other. So I think that all of that is what's going on in this particular case, and that's what the banks are relying on. They know, in effect, that so long as subjective values are positive, property that's a little bit underwater is not going to go into default if people have enough money to pay their mortgage from their other accounts. So the relationship is what's critical, and it's not simply the market value.
All right. We've got over 100 people, well over 100 people, and lots of questions lined up. Let's go to our first audience member.
Hello?
John Rowland, Constitution.org.
Hi, John.
Let's examine the theory as originally understood of eminent domain. That theory is that the sovereign, which after 1776 was a people, is the ultimate owner of all real property, and that what most of us have is claims on real property, and they're usually expressed as an estate, but it could be other kinds of claims, but that the state has is eminent domain power is limited to takings of real property, not personal property. State has never had authority to take personal property through eminent domain. They might take it through other theories, but the eminent domain power is limited to possessory and title, equitable title in real property.
Okay, let me sort of answer this question. When you're dealing with this issue, the text of the Constitution is broader. It's private property shall not be taken, and that embraces all forms of private property, land, chattels, animals, intellectual property, and so forth, and has been construed to do such. In practice, generally speaking, there is no need whatsoever to condemn most forms of personal property, because if you're worried about assembling a building, a road, the holdout problem is in fact dominant, and you don't need that. And the government finds it much easier to go out into the market and to buy a dozen pencils than to condemn a dozen pencils from a pencil factory or from a retailer. So it drops out. In this case, a mortgage is generally, and it's tricky, is generally regarded as a lien and therefore as an interest on real property. So that if you're turning out whether or not you could condemn a mortgage, the answer to that question is clearly yes. So to give the standard situation, suppose there's a home which has a mortgage on it, and the government needs it to build a road. It condemns the property. That means it takes both the mortgage and the equity and the interest, gives the money into a court, and what the court then does is first pay off the mortgagee because of his priority, and then gives the remainder, the so-called equity in the house, with respect to the homeowner. And if there are multiple mortgages, they get paid off in sequence of their priority and so forth. So I don't think that that's really the key issue in this particular case. I don't think that you can say that the kind of property at stake here is beyond the power of state for eminent domain. The tricky question is, if it turns out that this interest is held by somebody out of state and is now traded in all sorts of third markets along with other people, can you say that this is a somehow or other an extraterritorial reach by going at the creditor side, given all of these other transactions, or do we say that the entire mortgage is localized? This is a close case. The bank made its best argument that this is there. I actually think the extraterritorial argument is a little bit weaker than is the disruption of interstate commerce, which clearly is going to take place for what does not seem to be a very strong reason. And the fact that you happen to own the land on which the mortgage is secured does not, I think, justify the disruption of these interstate markets, which is so vital to the operation of a national financial economy. Next question, please.
Stand by. We'll get to the next question.
Yes, would this situation be helped if Congress or the California legislature enacted some kind of laws to prevent this sort of thing from happening?
Oh, God, yes. That's an easy question. If the state of California decided to stop it by virtue of the sort of internal organization of sovereignty inside the state, Richmond could be stopped from doing this without question. And the federal government has preemptive power, and to the extent that it decides to prohibit these sorts of transactions, that could happen as well. Indeed, now that you mention it, one of the arguments that you can make about this is that in addition to having yourself with a dormant commerce clause argument, you have an implied preemption argument, and the argument would be that if the extent that we allow Fannie and Freddie to enter into these markets, there's an implied power that they have to prevent their disruption by unilateral invalidation of these mortgages through the eminent domain powers by any kind of estate. And so what you would do is you would say that this local statute is preempted because it fundamentally frustrates a federal scheme. It is in conflict with the federal scheme that we start to have, and that the federal scheme occupies the field. I would think that the frustration and the conflict is stronger than the occupation arguments. But yes, if I were drafting this complaint, I would essentially add in yet another line on that particular element so as to raise that particular point. But I certainly hope that Congress would want to stop that, and at that point it's no longer implied preemption. It's simply an application of the Supremacy Clause.
Just a quick follow-up. Could Fannie and Freddie do that now even without legislation?
Interesting question, as we say. My view about it is I think if they went through a series of, not even hearings, but if they issued a considered judgment on this point, I would think it would certainly have a very good chance of standing up, saying in effect that, you know, to the extent that we have purchased these things, these transactions have strong elements of federal law, and the federal law will dominate the state law. There is a doctrine under Erie called the Clearwater Trust Doctrine, whatever its name was, in which it turned out that state law did not dominate in various kinds of transactions that involved the assignment of interests in paper, in which the federal government had an interest in those kinds of commercial paper. And so I think that you can make that argument. Look, I mean, let me put the answer to you in another way, which is actually more frightening, which is this is such a novel kind of situation that we really do not have any authoritative stuff. The one thing about it that's clearly wrong is the valuation argument on which all the investment bankers work, but the preemption, the dormant commerce clause, all of those arguments, I think, are extraterritorial arguments, are extremely important in trying to understand the grand nature of this situation.
Let's go to our next caller.
Yes, this is Joel Mandelman. I'm with the Civil Rights Working Group at the Heritage Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Two questions. First of all, was any thought given, or would you recommend also adding a paragraph, another count to the complaint, alleging that these seizures violate 42 U.S. Code 1983 and that these people acting under color of state law are depriving the owners of their civil right to own property by, in effect, stealing it for whether it's for the same value or for fair market value or less than fair market value should really be irrelevant.
Well, I think if you're saying this is a private taking, acting under color in state law, you might want to do it. I think the probably the thinking on this point is that the takings claim seems to be so powerful in and of its right, and the due process claim is the same thing. My interesting question, of course, is to what extent does the takings claim run against the mortgage resolution partners? And I think the answer is it does, because they're acting as an agent of a federal government or the state government or a city government, and it would be just a total scandal if they could escape the limitations of the Constitution by subcontracting out their particular power to a lesser authority. So the answer is I see no harm in adding it. My question is, does it increase substantially or even at all the likelihood of getting declaratory or injunctive relief? I don't think it changes that particular equation, but I think what it does do is again highlight an important fact, which is how utterly far from traditional modes of behavior this particular form of state action happens to be.
We've got four questions pending. If you want to join the queue, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Professor Epstein, this is Rob Sullivan, Florida Coastal. And I guess I want to start out by saying that I'm a big admirer of your scholarship in this area. And I say that because the way I ask this question may not reflect the level of admiration that I have.
That's okay. I've been paid. Many worse things have been said about me and to me.
Okay. The impression that I get from you is that, and what you've written in the past, is that you don't really have a strong philosophical objection to forced takings, that your analysis of whether or not a forced taking is permissible or not depends on a sort of a cost-benefit analysis between the cost to the individuals that are being taxed or regulated and the benefits of the government. And I guess my question is, if in this case the property was further underwater, would your objections to this particular taking go away, or would they still continue to exist?
They would still exist. Let me go back and explain what my position is, because I don't think you have it exactly right. I have never argued that in dealing with the question of whether or not there is a public use, a cost-benefit analysis applies. What I said is, if you in fact get the right rules with respect to compensation, it will force the government, when it decides to take or not to take, to internalize the losses to private people so that it will make a cost-benefit analysis, and that will result in the stoppage of projects that are net social losses and allow those which are net social gains to go forward. So the pricing system, in effect, that's put into place is, in fact, a way of curbing the government selection. Now, note, that is only government selections of takings for public use. So there is no constitutional guarantee that any individual has. If a government decides to take land for a hospital, that's a public use, and the hospital turns out to be a complete mistake, there's just nothing that you can do about it. But one of the things that you can help improve the situation is to make sure that when they take the land from the hospital, they give it its full value, because at that particular point, the financial burden on the state is going to be greater, at which point they're going to be more reluctant to use. The question then comes is, well, what do we mean by public use within this situation? And I think there are basically two classes of cases that fall within public use, neither of which is remotely involved here, and neither was remotely involved with respect to the Kelo case. The first is the conventional situation. Taking of land for public use is to putting the land to public use. And so that means that you can take the land in order to build the school or a road, but you cannot do that for any private purpose, like saying to build a spur for a railroad to some guy. And there's no question that that's a part of the sufficient situation. But if you go back historically, although the rationales were not fully articulated, at least starting with the Mill Acts in the 1860s and so forth, it became very clear to a large number of people that there were certain kinds of natural holdout situations that were created without the fault of either person, and that the eminent domain power would be a suitable way to overcome that particular difficulty. So the kind of case that you have is, I have a mountain, and there's a railroad which is located 5 miles away over somebody else's scrubland. And after the railroad is built, what I do is I now discover that there's valuable mine, you know, a mine or ore on the top of the mountain, and the only way to get it to market is through the railroad. And the question is whether or not you can build an overpass or a tramway of some sort so as to get the coal back to the tracks. And going back to the early part of the 20th century, 1905 or so, what the Supreme Court said is, in these peculiar circumstances, what you can do is to force the fellow to allow the tram to go over his land, to which he has no subjective value, so long as you pay him something equal to the loss, in order to stop the holdout question. Now, when you start to deal with Kelo, there's no holdout problem there at all. It's just an ordinary piece of land, and there was no evidence that it was needed because of an assembly. In fact, they had no idea what they were going to do with the particular property in question. And I think it would be very fanciful to say that there was a serious holdout problem in a situation like Midkiff, because there are always disputes between landlords and tenants, and those are the kind of low-level disputes that don't involve any third party, and there's no obvious sort of resource dislocation if the two people don't agree on the lease, and what you do is you have another tenant come in its place. In this particular situation, these mortgages are completely liquid. There's not as though you need to use this money for any particular public purpose that you can't fund out of taxation, and there's no market imperfection. So as far as I can see, the standard, slightly broader definition of public use doesn't cover it. Now, you said, what about if the mortgage is underwater? Now, that's a very fair question. This is, I think, the fair answer. There is a mortgagee in this particular case, and what happens is that mortgagee now has a variety of remedies, hopefully including a sensible system of foreclosure. And so what happens is, it will now, when it looks into its transactions, figure out how it values the underwater mortgage. And let's suppose what happens is that the lien is for $200,000, and it thinks that the undervalued underwater mortgage is worth $140,000. It's a taking, as far as I can see. If the city comes along and says, aha, this thing is now non-performing and underwater, and what we'll do is pay $100,000 for it. Can't do that. If, in fact, what you then have to do is to look at the value of the property in foreclosure so that the correct measure is no longer the measure of the lien on its face, it's the measure of the lien depreciated. And, in fact, there's one other element in this case. It's a terrible mortgage hazard, because one of the reasons why a lot of these mortgages get themselves underwater is what happens is the state, in my view, makes absolutely unprincipled limitations on the power to foreclose on these mortgages. What happens is a tenant in a or an owner in a real underwater situation just wants to hold out as long as he can, will put nothing to keep the property up. And the old rules on strict foreclosure were designed to get that owner out as quickly as possible because of the perverse incentives. So there is a double taking in those cases. There are first the impediments that are put with respect to the collection of this mortgage, and then in effect there's the undervalue after you've messed it up in another way. One of the things that happened at the time of Kelo is I could recall many people coming and saying, look, government wants to take my property. And what they've done is they've just stopped fixing the roads and giving us all sorts of local services, so the market value goes down. There's just a terrible hazard in these cases that the state, in its power of running public facilities and its power of running land use regulation of one kind or another, will in fact depreciate the very property that it wants to condemn. And one of the things that the Supreme Court has been very slow to deal with is in fact the notion that the government, when it takes lands, will exercise these collateral practices long before the actual taking takes place in order to lower its bill. It's a completely anti-social strategy. So I don't think, in effect, that I'm guilty of the charge that you make. And the question I'm going to ask you back is that answer satisfactory to you?
It's more than satisfactory. Thanks, Professor.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you.
All right, let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Professor. This is Mike from Sacramento, California. I apologize to all. I did not hear the beginning of your talk, and I'm curious to know in what court this case pends and what the name of the case, the parties is.
Oh, see, now you're asking me the kind of question which I'm very bad at answering. I have to figure out how to get this thing up. It's somewhere in California, and the case involves essentially a list of banks. There are 6,000 of them, hundreds of them, and on the other side of this, it turns out the two defendants are the city of Richmond on the one hand, and this mortgage resolution partnership on the other. So it's all of the bank industries against all of these things. If somebody has the information as to which particular court it is, that's fine. If not, I will basically get it up on my own machine.
It's the United States District Court, Northern District of California.
No, that seems right, because that would be essentially the, thank you, Dean. That's the court in which Richmond is located. It's along with San Francisco and Oakland and so forth. So that's one of the smart things about this complaint, is it picked an utterly non-controversial forum in which to litigate this issue. Look, these guys did a very good job on this thing. We haven't seen what the defendants have done, but I'd be stunned, if this thing actually goes. I certainly would give a temporary injunction. I think you meet all the standard factors on likelihood of success and gravity of disruption if the thing is allowed to go into place. And I also think on the end that they'll win on a per se judgment on the merits, at very least on the diminution of value issue for the points that I just talked about a moment before. It's just huge amounts of financial losses coming out of this thing. So I did not talk that, but you could read about all this stuff. I'm going to be writing about it, obviously, afterwards. Okay, next.
Thank you.
Sure, my pleasure. Hello?
Professor Epstein, I have two questions. First, who are you, please? Oh, I'm sorry, Bill Severson, Seattle. First question is, do you have any sense of whether or not the city of Richmond might decide to just go away rather than face the cost of the lawsuit? And then the second sort of more substantive question is, isn't this going to your holdout analysis, isn't this a good case to kind of revisit Kelo, I guess, a little bit on the question of this proper scope of eminent domain, with the notion that the policy of that is to get into public hands property or real estate, or I guess it could be personal property, where the government needs that particular item of property for some public purpose, as opposed to just fungible money. I mean, if you're just taking money, that's their ability to do that is really the tax power, not
that is correct.
Domain power. And here it seems to me that this could be a good vehicle for challenging that overly broad notion of public use that's reflected in Kelo.
Yes, let's sort of take the questions in order. I have no private information as to what the local folks in the city of Richmond have thought. I can't believe that when this thing was proposed to them by the mortgage people, right, that they were not at risk for the fact that this thing could actually go and get blown up. So my guess is that there may well be an agreement that the actual cost of defending this case will not be borne by the city, but will be borne by the mortgage resolution partners. I think that's quite possible. So once you factor that into the situation, it's a different calculation. It's no longer just the question as to whether or not it's worth it to the city of Richmond to do this thing. The question is whether or not the mortgage resolution guys will get enough clout out of winning this particular case that having won it, they can then sell this thing to hundreds of other cities. And so I think, in effect, given those kinds of straits, it's a very different sort of calculation. And, you know, who's going to – so that's the first thing. And then the question is whether this thing is worth it or whether it's just going to go away. I think the answer is probably no. And as to the question of whether or not it's going to lead to a revisiting of the public use question, you don't have to get to the Supreme Court for that. That's going to be front and center at the first round of cases. And what will happen is it will be a means-ends decision. If you go back to certain kinds of cases for example, a case called Berman against Parker from about 1954, the elimination of urban blight has been thought to be a legitimate public purpose in a very broad station of the police power as it relates to public use by Justice William O. Douglas. Right? You go to California, and it's a very strange location, to put it mildly. And they have held, for example, that you can have blight authority to make sure that you could condemn property in which, I'm quoting at least one case that I heard about, I can't verify, in which it turns out that there's a collection of leaves on somebody's tennis court. That is, they do it very, very well. But I think it's going beyond the pale to say that if you are trying to use the blight argument to deal with not the party in possession, who's always subject to some kind of review, but to deal with a mortgagee when the party in possession is performing his loans, or where the bank is perfectly happy to renegotiate this kind of a transaction. So I think the answer on blight is, if you've got an issue with blight, what you do is go after the party who's in possession of the land, and to go in this convoluted type situation is therefore, I think, something that will not be regarded as permissible under the public use doctrine. You know, I'm just making predictions. The Supreme Court has done many bizarre things, but I think this case is so raw on the emotions that this would be a case in which it would be quite happy to draw the line. And maybe it will try to retrench a little bit on Kelo in light of the change in public reactions, but it doesn't have to do that to distinguish this case. Okay, thank you.
Richard, for what it's worth, the Mortgage Resolution Partners website has a document entitled Frequently Asked Questions, and question number 10, how do you plan to address the legal backlash that could occur, is answered at least in part. We will provide resources to defend against any legal challenge.
Oh, now, where did I come up with that? I did not know that, but essentially it has to be that way, right? I mean, no city is going to sort of take this thing. And the argument is asymmetrical states. Now, remember, the big guys on both sides of this thing, and I don't think if it's kind of a straight resource battle that those people are going to have sufficient amount of monies to sort of wear down in a war of attrition Wells Fargo Bank and all of the other securitization arrangements in this case. I also think, by the way, that they are making, and I think it's a serious miscalculation, the view that if this thing starts to have some degree of promise in the courts, that there will not be a fairly violent legislative reaction, particularly at the federal level.
A la Kelo. We do have two questions pending and about 5 minutes left, so let's turn to the next question.
Okay.
Hi, Bob McNamara from the Institute for Justice.
Oh, hi, Bob.
How are you doing, Richard?
Well, I'm fine.
Always good to hear from you. I don't want to draw too much focus from the very important constitutional questions at the core of this case, but I'd be really interested in hearing any take you have on actually the ripeness and justiciability arguments, whether you think the case is ripe now given the steps Richmond's taken.
You know, I haven't actually given that any serious kind of thought, but, you know, you're a practicing lawyer, so you probably know better than I do. But this is the way in which I would think about it. What happens is you're trying to sue for an injunction. You're trying to sue for a declaratory judgment. You're not trying to bring any kind of case for damages. And so all the estimation questions that might make this thing premature just sort of drop out of this case. And so the analysis that I do when I'm talking about ripeness for adjudication and so forth is to ask, what information am I able to gain by waiting? And in this particular challenge, the only thing that you're going to do is to say, oh, the numbers are wrong. It wasn't 190 and 160. It was 195 and 155, or the other way around. And since all of the particular changes that don't matter are the only things that are likely to happen, my view is I would fairly emphatically reject this thing on the ground that there are serious dislocations in waiting because it keeps the entire world in an unnecessary state of uncertainty when there is no information about the underlying dispute that can be gained from the delay. Does that strike you as reasonable, Bob?
That strikes me as perfectly reasonable.
Okay, well then, we're on the same page, guys. All right.
We've got time for a final question. Let's go to our final caller.
Yeah, I just want to ask, do you know which lawyer, who's representing any of the plaintiffs? We might be able to get copies of the complaint.
Oh, I mean, look, it's easy to get copies of this complaint. It's all over the landscape. I keep closing my volume, and I know that, whatchamacallit has it, but you just type in Richmond Eminent Domain, and the thing just comes popping out. And I'm sure what I'm now going to offer Neil, Dean's services, I think you can just simply post along with this thing a copy of the certified complaint, right?
We will, Richard. That's a good idea. When we post the audio for this call, we will include a link to the copy of the complaint and maybe at some point the answer.
Yeah, the answer, by the way, won't come for a long time. The wheels of justice grind exceedingly slow. I mean, the question is whether or not if they try to implement this, you will get an immediate motion for a TRO. And my strong inclination is that you will, and that you might actually even get Fannie and Freddie to come off the bench and to take a much more active role in this case. This thing will not go away because the dispute is far beyond this. There will be no national mortgage market if states can and municipalities can pull individual private mortgages out from the pool. And just think of the situation. How do you now value pools of assets if, in fact, they're randomly distorted by unilateral action, by opportunistic actors? And the only thing that you know is that whatever you had in the pool is going to be worth more than the money you're going to get from it. This is not a way to promote the stability. I can't condemn strongly enough what I regard as the insane rapacity associated with this particular scheme, wholly apart from the constitutional merits.
Strong words. What, you want to let that be your final thoughts,
well,
Richard?
Well, I was trying to get some strong words in there. This moderation sometimes does not suit me.
Well,
okay, but thank everybody for listening.
Yes, and let me, on behalf of the Federal Society, thank you, Professor Richard Epstein, for joining us today, especially on such short notice. As we mentioned at the outset, this is a case that was just filed earlier this week, and it is novel, so we appreciate your insights. To our audience, thank you, obviously, for dialing in and for your participation in the call. We invite you to check the Federal Society's website and monitor your emails for announcement on future calls. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Okay, thank you all.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.